clicker. Just.
You can use the roller ball, or if you want, I'll page down for you.
Okay, so I can just. Okay, but then I can go back if I. Okay. Good afternoon. So before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge Lori Stillman, who edited this report and who's the director of the Asthma Regional Council of New England, and who I believe is presenting right now in another room. And I have no relationships to disclose. So the basis of this presentation is a report that Lori Stillman had asked me to pull together and write about a year ago. So I conducted an assessment, a national assessment of smoke-free housing policies. And there's a copy, actually several copies of this report in the back of the room if you'd like to pick one up. This presentation will just touch on the many pieces of information that are in this report. So the Asthma Regional Council of New England is a collaboration of federal, state, and local agencies across six New England states that are working in health, education, housing, and the environment to collectively address environmental contributors to asthma. And over the past 7 years of its existence, much of its work and priorities have been based on asthma surveillance. And in their 2004 regional analysis, as you can see here, they found that not only did 1 in 10 children in the region have asthma, but that those rates were 44% higher among children who lived in households with a smoker. So they were very interested in looking at ways to reduce children's exposure to secondhand smoke. So the purpose of this presentation is to look at this complex issue, because it is a complex issue and these policies are controversial, and to determine how best to assess attitudes, costs, and implementation for adopting smoke-free housing policies. I'll share with you samples of voluntary and regulatory policies, although there are many more in the report, and present considerations for implementation by property owners and managers. And then at the very end, there's several dozen websites, so again, I encourage you to pick up a copy so that you don't have to try and scribble them down or go to the electronic version of this conference. So the problem of secondhand smoke, it is a serious public health hazard. In 2006, then U.S. Surgeon General Carmona issued a report saying that the scientific evidence is now indisputable. Secondhand smoke is not just an annoyance, it's a serious health hazard that can lead to disease and premature death in children and non-smoking adults. There are also special populations that are particularly vulnerable. This is the case with children and with senior citizens. This slide lists some of the health problems that are associated with exposure to secondhand smoke. And there's also the issue of health disparities with tobacco in terms of marketing, and also just the disproportionate burden of tobacco-related morbidity and mortality. This persists among low-income, less educated, and underserved minority populations. Specifically, one example from the Surgeon General's report is that African Americans disproportionately suffer and die from smoking-related diseases. So why housing? So different reports, different studies have shown that there are higher rates of smoking and asthma in affordable housing. The Boston Public Health Commission and ARC did a study that found this was the case. Moreover, according to FEMA, careless smoking is a leading cause of fire death. So it's both a public safety and a public health issue. And multi-unit housing presents a particular challenge because of the shared ventilation and the issue of smoke incursion. So I'm sure many of you are familiar with hotels where smoking is not allowed because the smoke can blow from room to room, from common areas. And it's the same approach with multi-unit housing, whether it be condominiums, apartments, assisted living facilities, group homes, shelters, and public housing. So we do want to be very clear. This is not just a low-income public housing issue. This applies to condominiums and apartments as well. So what is smoke-free housing? And those of you who are from California are probably very familiar with this term because the state has taken the lead on the issue, and we're just catching up in New England at this point in time. But it refers to guidelines, rules, and legislation that imposes restrictions about where smoking can and cannot occur on the property of multi-unit dwellings, examples like I have just shared. And these policies may be voluntary or they may be mandatory, and I'll give some examples of both. We recommend in this report, our findings show that really the best approach is to combine voluntary regulatory approaches with educational approaches. I interviewed 17 individuals from 11 states, and some of those coalitions and health agencies were generous enough to share some of their earlier assessment findings as well. And really any you know, this is consistently what we heard from all of them, that a combined approach is the most effective. And any approach should really be augmented with cessation efforts, with access to resources and referrals. And I would also refer you to the Center for Tobacco Policy and Organizing. They have a matrix of local smoke-free housing policies that's excellent, and that's based here in California. So why now? Why support smoke-free housing at this point in time? I had listed before the Surgeon General's report. Also, the President's Cancer Panel and the National Institute of Medicine released a report calling for more restrictive policies, recognizing that environmental changes were needed to support individual behavior change. Sorry for the typo there, in terms of the percentage of residents who no longer allow smoking in their own homes, and this is both single-family housing and multi-unit housing. So nationally, in 1993, 43% of people said that they did not allow smoking in their homes. That increased in 2002 to 66%. It's a little bit higher in Massachusetts at 76%, so there's a lot of public support for these measures. Other assessments have shown that potential tenants and condominium buyers prefer smoke-free properties, thereby increasing their marketability. And smoking units are quite expensive for owners. It costs up to five times as much to turn over a smoking unit as a non-smoking unit, as you can all imagine for anyone who's moved into an apartment or hotel room where somebody was smoking, in terms of carpet, the smell in the walls, the drapes, that sort of thing. So here's an example of a model policy from California. And what I really like about this example is that it's very clear about who is in covered, who's covered by this, who's the intended covered groups: tenants, visitors, and employees. And it's very specific about what the common areas consist of. And they list a number of examples of the types of buildings that are covered here. Again, condominiums, nursing homes, assisted living facilities. And then they get very specific, too, in listing the common areas in terms of hallways, laundry rooms, garages, gyms, etc. And that's very important for enforcing these policies, to be as clear and specific as possible. Now, here's a model policy from the state of Washington, a curb-to-curb example, where the entire property is smoke-free. Smoking is prohibited indoors and out, private units, common areas, near doorways, anywhere on the property. So that's the most extensive kind of policy that you can enact. And again, they cite the reasons why: public safety and public health. And they talk about who it applies to, and they have an expanded version including service persons, owners, and employees. So here's a sample policy for Maine. I won't go through all of it because it's very similar to the Washington policy, but this is a useful slide in that it talks about the incentives that states can put out for developers and for property owners in terms of building affordable housing that is smoke-free. Some of you may be familiar with the qualified allocation plan, which is basically a tax credit that's offered to applicants who are looking to build affordable housing. And in a competitive process, that's a good incentive to get them to pursue that end. So some considerations. Often people ask about, well, what's the cost involved? And for owners or building managers, the costs are really just in changing the wording in the leasing or in the lease agreement, changing wording in advertising, posting the signs, and communicating it to residents or potential residents. There's also some costs involved for health agencies, especially if they're starting from scratch and starting up a website, say for a smoke-free housing registry, doing print materials, getting the word out. So there are some costs initially, but pays out over time. A lot of questions about legality. People ask, can you regulate people's behavior in their homes? And again, to be clear, we're not what these policies are telling people is not that they have to stop smoking, although certainly that's encouraged for their health. It's merely saying that they cannot smoke in their home. And so it's similar to restrictions concerning pets. We've all been familiar with places where you can't have a cat or a dog. It has been challenged in court, and it has held up. I have some examples of cases, and they're in the report if anyone's interested. Something to keep in mind with disenfranchised communities and health disparities: it's one thing if a person owns a condominium and it goes smoke-free. If you're a smoker, you can sell your condominium and move to another building, buy one, and one that allows smoking. However, if you have more limited economic means, or you've been living in a place for years and years, you may not have as many opportunities to move, you may not want to. So this is something to keep in mind, that there's no one-size-fits-all approach to this, that you've really got to do your homework and understand what your resident picture looks like before you move to enacting policies, because you want to adopt the right combination. So here's a long list of the pros and cons of smoke-free policies, both for voluntary and regulatory. And I'm not going to go through all of them. You can read them for yourself. In the report, we do highlight some that are specific for voluntary and others that are specific for regulatory. And I just want to highlight the regulatory ones very briefly. The value in a regulatory ordinance that comes at the county, city, or state level is that it has a broader impact, greater sustainability, and it can be more enforceable because it has the weight of government behind it. However, there may be greater costs involved. It might entail a lengthier process, and generally people are more receptive to voluntary policies. As you know, a lot of people don't like to be told what to do, especially in their own homes. So as it says there, it may be viewed as an intrusion of privacy. So in implementing smoke-free policies, these are the steps we've outlined for success. It's imperative to assess attitudes and behaviors. If 85% of the residents on a property are smoking and they don't support smoke-free housing policies, it's going to be very difficult to enact this. However, if only 10% of the people are smokers, then it's going to look very different. To outline the goals and objectives, again, if you have a property, say, that has three buildings, it might be possible to have one that goes smoke-free entirely, or two that go smoke-free entirely and smoking still allowed in one. However, if you're talking about a building, say, that has 100 units, people have been creative in looking at how the ventilation systems work. So it might be that one wing is smoke-free and the others allow smoking. Again, it's really looking at what are you seeking to accomplish before you select the voluntary and regulatory policies. What is the end goal in this effort? To compile a list of stakeholders and convene a meeting, this is essential in any effort. To review the existing policies and regulations. And again, really, I would encourage you to look to the report because rather than reinventing the wheel, there's a lot of really great model policies that are already out there that span the continuum of very restrictive to less restrictive. So be worth your time to take a look at those existing policies. To educate and organize, particularly residents. To choose a focus. As I said, the nature of addressing this issue in condominiums is very different than in apartments and in housing authorities. To draft the policies, adopt and communicate them, again, assisting existing tenants who smoke with cessation efforts, which include referrals and resources, and then, of course, to enforce the policies. Now, the enforcement piece, sometimes people ask what happens when somebody violates the policies, and it's generally handled like other lease violations, and that there are warnings, possibly fines. I have been asked a number of times, too, if there are any cases nationally where anyone's been evicted, and I was not able to come across any in the conversations with folks in 11 different states. I don't think that's the goal for anyone. I think that's the initial concern of tenants, and so I think it's important in terms of communicating the new policies to residents and tenants that is not the intention and that management certainly would work with folks, you know, enforcing them, but certainly not leading to evictions, not as a first step anyway. All right, so very quickly, some guidance for stakeholders. And there's some that apply across the board to these different categories of stakeholders. As I had already mentioned, it's very important to look at what percentage of smokers you already have and also possibly include a grandfather clause. So for that person who's been living there for 30 years, they can continue to live there and smoke there, but when they've moved out, then it becomes a smoke-free unit. I hope I talked about the importance of partnerships across government, health agencies, property owners, and the residents so that everyone has input in the crafting and application of these policies. I guess given the remaining time I have left, I'd like to focus on the four things that legislators and elected officials can do. The first is to promote smoke-free housing, much in the same way that states have promoted smoke-free workplaces. By passing countywide or citywide ordinances, it gives a lot more teeth to these policies. To legally designate secondhand smoke as a public nuisance, it gives a legal basis, gives recourse to residents who are being disturbed by a neighbor smoking. As I mentioned, the tax credit benefit, that would be something that would have to come at a legislative or a government level. And also for, again, in backing up these ordinances, to enact fines, much in the same way that smoke-free workplaces have fines, where inspectors come in, and if there's a violation, they respond to it as such. So I think that's everything. I just wanted to emphasize, again, the importance of the smoke-free housing registry. There is a national one that exists. It's run by Esther Schiller out of Southern California, so I would recommend that you take a look at that for some ideas. There's a lot of great work being done across the country, perhaps even in your state. And there's a very long list of useful websites on this slide and the next. And so I thank you for your time and attention.